Hello, and welcome to the Television Spotlight on the Comic Book Cage podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about a television show that we think you'll enjoy. In this episode, I am joined by my sister Kay, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on Season 2 of The Gifted. Not only might we spoil Season 2 and Season 1, we may also talk about some X-Men-related movies. The Gifted is the show that was on Fox that was X-Men-adjacent, and it's one of those that was really adjacent to the X-Men, in so much as they referenced the X-Men a few times, didn't really name-drop any of the characters from the X-Men themselves, but a lot of really lesser X-Men characters were in the show.
Well, but they made a lot of allusions to Magneto.
But never called him Magneto.
True.
That's the line they danced. Anything that was stuff you would really recognize from the movies wasn't mentioned. No Professor X. Magneto was referenced with his medallion and stuff, but not called by name. Polaris, who was an actual early X-Men. The original run of X-Men lasted to about issue 64. Five-ish, then went into essentially reruns in the comic before coming back. And she was one of the ones that was in that original run of 60, 70 issues or whatever. So she is the most iconic X-Men we've got here. But we have Thunderbird, who was one of the new X-Men or in the giant-size X-Men stuff. So kind of the second wave of characters when they had introduced Wolverine and Colossus and Storm and stuff like that. Thunderbird died on the first mission.
Man.
So didn't last too long. Blink was one that had shown up and died quickly, but then an alternate reality version of her, alternate timeline version, starred in Exiles for like about 100 issues.
Mm.
So had more success out of the team than in the team. And she's in here. The other characters, the most recognizable ones from the X-Men comics would be Sage, who's very much a supporting cast member at best.
She got better treatment Season 1.
Much better. He or she barely got a word in edgewise.
He or she really...
Most of her screen time was when she was killed off.
Yeah, he or she was treated like an extra that they were considering moving up to speaking role.
Yeah, she got a line or two here and there, but nothing compared to what she got first season. And not that she got a ton there.
Well, but if you hadn't reminded me, she was a character from first season, and she was a meaningful character. I was sitting here going, first of all, should I recognize her? Because she does seem familiar. But second of all, the way they were using the character actually reminded me of the computer techish person in some of the later seasons of Castle.
Yes.
Where it was someone that we just kind of got familiar with seeing, and at first it was just, oh, I can bring that up for you. And then gradually she got three or four lines of dialogue, and eventually it was so exciting she got a name.
Many shows have that recurring character that you get to know, then you get to know the name of, and you then realize it's been a while since we've seen them, sort of a thing.
Yeah.
But it takes you a while to realize that. She was one of those this season where she'd show up a few times, she'd have a line or two, nothing pivotal, but it was kind of, I don't say the hailing frequencies open equivalent kind of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody had to say something.
Yeah.
But anybody could have said that. And then we noticed she was out for a few episodes and didn't really matter, but she was much more pivotal in the first season.
Yeah. It felt like the only reason she was, well, at the end of first season, we had a major split.
Yes.
In the Mutant Underground, and half went and joined the Inner Circle and half stayed in the Mutant Underground. And it really felt like the only reason she went with the group to the Inner Circle was so she could be killed off.
Well, so they had somebody going to the Inner Circle other than Polaris and Andy Von Strucker.
But a few other people did go.
Did we ever see any of them again?
I'm pretty sure Fade was one of them.
Okay, you're right. Fade was one of them.
And they just didn't take the time to remind us of that.
Yeah, they could have done a better job at the beginning of the season reasserting where things had been, because it had been over a year since we'd watched, and that's on us.
Well, but even for the people for whom it had been 3 months.
Yes.
I think they should have taken the time to reassert who had been a team prior to that break.
Yeah, I think they definitely could have done better. The other character that was first season to second season had a shift, and the actress got promoted to regular was Skylar, I forget her last name, who played Esme, Sophie, and Phoebe Frost. Now, the Frost last name is interesting because they were the Stepford Cuckoos in the comic. The 5-in-1, then the 4-in-1, then the 3-in-1, as various members got killed off. Different ones got killed off in the comic than here. But they were a hive mind telepathy that was later retconned into being, and who knows if it was the original plan or not, but it was eventually revealed they were clones of Emma Frost, who is, out of the hierarchy of telepaths in the X-Men canon, probably around position number 3.
Mm-hmm.
Professor X tops the list. Jean Grey next on the list. And the two, you could argue, which is top, which is not, because both are pivotal. Emma Frost, one of the other major telepaths. Then you have Psylocke. Then you've, I mean, there's a plethora of them. There's no shortage of telepaths in the mutant world.
Well, at one point, I wondered if we got an allusion to Professor X's academy. When Polaris is trying to figure out where her baby Dawn can be safe. And Esme says...
Oh, there's a school.
Yeah.
It's over in the Netherlands, somewhere overseas, so I didn't take it as such. If it had been up in Westchester.
See, and that's what I thought. I was sitting there going, but she says it's in Switzerland, so I don't think it is.
Yeah, I didn't take it as that. But the majority of these characters, because there were a few other characters that we had. We had, what do they call him? Was it Eclipse? They didn't use his code name that often. The one with the light powers. That was dating Lorna, Polaris.
Oh, Marcus.
Marcus, thank you. His code name, I think, is Eclipse. They didn't use it at all this season. I think they used it last. He was kind of their version of Sunspot. Solar powers. And he was well used, I think, this season.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of those where all of this is dancing around the X-Men not being around inexplicably.
Mm-hmm.
Sentinel Services hunting down mutants. There's the whole, you know, bigotry thing, which I thought was played reasonably well in front and center this season.
Yes.
They covered similar ground to the season of Supergirl, where they were dealing with aliens and such. And a lot of it is you've got these people that are fundamentally different. They have powers and abilities. People are scared of them. Therefore, they must be bad. We must, you know, round them up and cage them.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because last season we had the we must experiment on them and confine them. But we never really had the we should simply imprison them or put them in internment camp type theory. And we went through quite a few schools of thought in this one season.
You know, it'd be interesting to have a show where you've got people with powers. And there is the discussion of do we round them up and stuff, but not do it without cause. You know what I mean? Play it literally as that bigotry, that racist angle. And it's like people could understandably be afraid of somebody who could bend steel in their bare hands or shoot ray blasts out of their eyes or you know, whatever power you want to toss out there. But if there is zero practical cause, or maybe there's a few incidents out of all of these people that have powers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to play up almost the political aspect of it,
yeah,
could be a lot more interesting. Here, it's just they're always getting chased by Sentinel Services. They're always on the run. And it's unclear what percentage of the population has mutant abilities.
Or the X gene.
Or the X gene. But those that are manifesting. There's enough that everybody's aware of mutants. It's a hot button issue.
Well, but at one point, there's a reference to... You have to get the gene test. You can't do this if you have the X gene.
Yeah, but it's one thing if it's, you know, 1 in 1,000,000. It's another thing if it's 1 in 1,000.
Yeah.
Because if it's 1 in 1,000,000, geez, these people are all finding each other and there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
So it seemed like it's more common than that. But if it's like 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, it's like, then how could you possibly control that large of a population?
Mm-hmm.
I thought a lot of this show and this season was almost overly, I don't say melodramatic.
It was, and in a schizophrenic manner. And by that, I mostly mean Turner.
Yeah, it took a while for Turner's arc to get going. It's like, why are we still following him this season? He's out of Sentinel Services. He winds up going and joining the Purifiers and, you know, being a major part of that arc. But where I felt they left at the end of the season was him was unsatisfying.
Well, he's very reactive.
Yes.
And so it's kind of the wind keeps blowing him and turning him in different directions. And that's why for me it was kind of schizophrenic. Because first he goes, because I'm going to help the cops. I'm right, and I'm not the crazy person people are trying to convince others I am. The cops turn him away, but one cop is a purifier.
And recruits him for the purifiers. Right.
And then it's, I'm not going to join a hate group. But he goes to the purifiers because they're the only ones willing to listen to him. And he basically listens to the speech being given, and it's kind of a, maybe I can turn the hate group into something useful.
Yeah, he can channel the people who want to do right but are not doing it the right way.
Yeah.
And then eventually, I don't even think he ever realizes that the Purifiers were basically pawns of the inner circle of the Hellfire Club.
No, no. He never does his due diligence on the people he's working for or with, even when he knows they gave him bogus info on a mission.
Well, he tries to, but then gets caught up with his cop friend has been killed.
Again, because the wind blew.
Yeah. Well, and at the end of the season, the television guy who's been fanning the flames and secretly running the purifiers is outed and is publicly acknowledging, through mind control, of course, that he's been doing that. So it's now known, and this is the guy who's been, you know, pulling the strings on Jace Turner. But Jace Turner is, you know, presumably in a coma or something after his injuries.
Well, he's in a hospital bed in a very sterile-looking white hospital place with strange men in black suits.
Something's going on there. The question is, are they going to experiment on him? Who has him and why?
Exactly.
But at that point, he is unaware of the status quo of the purifiers. It puts him into a similar position he was in at the beginning of the season, except not having come out of Sentinel Services, but at this point coming out of the Purifiers.
Yeah.
So the question is, where would they have gone with him in a third season?
Yeah.
Now, there is no third season. And frankly, I don't know that there should be.
Yeah,
I don't. It was an okay show. It was not bad. It was decent.
Well, there were a lot of times when they started to go towards something interesting and then stopped short.
I think part of the problem I have with this show is they were trying to do an X-Men show, blatantly no X-Men.
Yes. In a world without X-Men, currently.
Yes, the X-Men had been in, but are inexplicably gone. And the problem I had is the lead four characters that are our vehicle through the show are the Struckers. And they are the grandkids in, I'm trying to figure out how they fit in the comic stuff. In the comics, there's Baron von Strucker, who is a World War II, basically, villain.
Mm-hmm. That's Andreas, the grandfather of Reed in this.
In this. However, Andreas and Andrea in the comics were modern day, filling the role of Andy and Lauren here. Mm-hmm. And they were the Fenris twins. And they were extremely powerful mutants that could use their powers in tandem to even amp it up.
Yeah.
So those two in the comic are X-Men related characters, but Baron von Strucker is more of either a Hydra or almost a Captain America villain, I think. I'd have to go double check. But to have that arc being such a major part of this show,
mm-hmm.
when there's so many mutant things to go deal with.
Well, and I mean, we dealt with trying to set up the mutant homeland.
Mm-hmm.
And really, what we did in the way of trying to set up the mutant homeland was to get mutants to rise up.
Well, to get mutants to rise up and to tear down the U.S. And it's like, you haven't found any land, you haven't tried to establish anything. There was a show, and it might have been the 4400, people with powers, yada yada. But they had basically gotten to where, in the last season, they had taken this one chunk of this one town and put a force field around it and said, this is ours. And then at one point, they took their little force field devices and marched them out 10 feet or 100 feet or whatever.
Yeah.
And said, this is ours.
Well,
and then the next week they did it again. And it was one of those people realizing, they've doubled their footprint.
I mean, in a story with mutants, if you go out into, what, Arizona, New Mexico, where you have wide open spaces of land going for 15 cents an acre because it's so hot in the summer, people don't want to live there. But you've got mutants who can effectively terraform.
Yeah.
When you think about it. And you've got mutants who can move the ground so they can effectively create the environment they want. Not just climate, but structures.
They've done that approach at times with the X-Men comics, where they've got something in the middle of nowhere, they've terraformed it, they've gotten their own thing. What I would have considered doing with this sort of a show is I would have had it focus on the Guthrie family. Now, in the comics, there is a family of mutants, the Guthries. Sam Guthrie is the most, one of the most prominent. It's a family from Middle America, farm country. I forget exactly where. Sam was recruited into the New Mutants as, at the time, kind of the second major class of X-Men. After the original class, after the new X-Men, this is the new student body, of which there were like five or six. He went under the codename Cannonball.
Mm-hmm.
He had the ability to have kind of a propulsive force that could just blast him forward and kind of almost a force field-like thing around him. So he could just cannonball through things. He could fly, but couldn't really steer and stuff like that originally. Hence the codename. But his younger sister... Let me make sure I get this right. I was about to confuse it with Colossus. His younger sister was Magic. Sam's younger sister was, I think it was Paige. She went by the name of Husk. She could basically almost like shed her skin and have another mutant power for a duration. So it was like a rotating thing. But the thing was, there were like eight kids in this family, all of which were mutants of one sort or another. And I'm not even sure if all of them had their powers developed before they got, you know, killed off or whatever. But if you do something, almost do the justified route. Out in the middle, you know, modern problems, but I don't say backwater situations.
Mm-hmm.
But do something like that. Something where you take one of the lesser known established families of mutants in the comics and kind of tell their story.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, we had the people who wanted to create a homeland but had no land.
Well, no plan for it. They just wanted to rebel.
Yeah. Well, and they seem to be perfectly fine with killing off the humans because the humans want to kill us off. And when you see the purifiers, who are the flip side of that coin, the humans who want to kill off the mutants because the mutants want to kill off us, you can see where that attitude has come from.
But if they had done something where, imagine they had taken this and set it such that the mutants could have taken over, like, Catalina Island off Southern California. And she said, you know what? You don't want us. We don't want you. We're going to take this place. We'll have trade relations, but you leave us alone, we'll leave you alone.
Yeah.
Okay. That's at least grounds for something.
Yeah.
You know, people who are on Catalina might not like it, but something to where, if you're trying to establish a homeland, establish a homeland. Maybe not do it in D.C., Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and that's what kept confusing me on that one.
Well, and when some of the riots or stuff were happening, there were fires all over town. It was a major thing. And then a few days later, it's like nothing happened.
Yeah. Well, and then we go to the university in North Carolina or South Carolina for help. And now we meet the doctor whose plan for peace on Earth is, again, there be only one species, but she's going to basically cure the mutants.
Cure the mutants, turn them back into humans.
Yeah.
And that's why I think there's a possibility of a show that is, I don't say a debate show almost, but if it's something to where it's not so clear cut, it's not like they're humans, we're beyond humans, or vice versa kind of a thing. Something, if you took the situation, played it initially as if it is a bigotry race war sort of a thing, but then flip it in terms of a gender thing. Imagine if all the men wanted to wipe out the women or all the women wanted to wipe out the men. It's not going to work out for either side.
Yeah.
You need both.
Yeah.
And if you could figure that kind of dynamic out, because the fallacy I've always seen with treating mutants or superhumans or aliens or you know, whatever, somebody, some group that is sentient beings with abilities beyond that of the other sentient group. We saw this in Alienation, where newcomers came and they were stronger, faster, smarter, etc. Supergirl with the aliens, you know, this here and stuff. The fallacy with that is there is legitimate factual reasons for there to be a friction between the two groups.
Yeah.
One is fundamentally more powerful than the other.
Mm-hmm.
Whether the numbers are there or not, kind of a thing. There is something legitimate to fear.
Yeah, well, and this show did do a decent job showing absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Mm-hmm. But if you can find a way to where it's not just, I don't like them because they're different,
mm-hmm.
but that difference is fundamentally threatening me by its very existence.
Well, and when we were at the university, we had the professor that Kate Burton was mm-hmm. playing. And she, I mean, very talented actress. And she was doing a good job both hiding her motives, but then when her truth came out, and you juxtapose her with the student, Noah, and they both wanted to find a way to suppress and cure the X gene, but for very different reasons.
The problem I had was the professor had flat out said about the girl with Down syndrome who could grow plants, that there was nothing to cure.
Yes.
What made that one not worth curing, yet you want to wipe out the mutant gene everywhere else? There was a...
I think the fact she had Down syndrome and the fact that her power was non-harmful, or she did not have the intellectual capacity to use it to harm.
I guess. To me, that's splitting hairs.
To me, it was being able to show herself in the light she wanted to be seen, so that she wouldn't be confused with the purifiers her brother had started.
Yeah, I just would like to see these shows get more nuanced
mm-hmm.
in the discussion and treatment of this versus, yeah, he could shoot lightning, therefore we must wipe out all mutants.
Well, yeah, and like I said, they started to get into something interesting there at the university. And then instead of even discussing the two different reasons for wanting to come up with a quote cure
mm-hmm.
in terms of the medical student Noah without something to help him control or suppress his power, he would vibrate anything and everything around him to the point of destruction. His home, his family, everything. It was ruining his life.
He was similar then to Richter in the comics, who had vibrational type powers. I hadn't put that together previously. What would have been interesting, though, is if Reed's power had gotten a little out of control and she'd seen him destroy something and said, see what a threat you are? This is why we've got to cure it. And he pointed out the only reason he was in that state was because of their manipulation.
Yeah.
If they had let him go a normal course, he would have control of his powers.
But her philosophy and her stand was that the only use for his power was destruction. His power by its nature was everything I touch is destroyed. There
yes.
was no constructive use for his power. Therefore, his power had to be turned off, suppressed, eradicated.
That would be like suggesting a scalpel can't be used for good because all it can do is cut things.
Exactly.
So if they had had that discussion.
Yes. And that's what the show was lacking.
Yeah.
Yes.
It had decent action. It had good effects. A couple of times it was better than others.
I was going to say, towards the end, two buildings blew up, and I was like,
Well, what got me was at least one of them, when it blew up, it was basically down to the steel girders unharmed, but the rest of the building was toast.
Yeah. Could still see the stairwells.
The staircases,
unharmed.
Yet, you know.
Yeah.
What got me was, as the attack was starting to happen, there were already people running out.
Oh, that's funny.
So there was some stuff there. I think the actors, by and large, were good.
Yes.
Did a fairly good job. I think the writing was decent.
Mm-hmm.
But it was one of those that I would not have expected to go beyond, really one season, to be honest. The fact it got a second, I think, is a little surprising. Because it was not a high-concept show. It was not easy entrance later in the run.
I would agree.
And it was almost, I don't want to say cliche, but it lacked more sophisticated, I don't want to say sophistication, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
A deeper level.
Yeah. It didn't go into the deeper conversations. It stopped at the surface. And every time it started to get to the point where, oh, that could be really interesting if you explored it, they turned away rather than do that exploration.
We never really got a deep understanding as to why Reva was trying to create a mutant homeland to begin with, or why she was doing it this way.
The only thing we got was some throwaway lines about she came from, I think she even called it the mutant ghettos of Chicago.
Well, and we saw her friend get killed.
Yeah, and that's about all we got.
But how did that lead to this, and mm-hmm. why? We never really got, to my satisfaction at least.
Or how she got into the Hellfire Club, or how she got access to their funding.
How did she find Ryan? How did she convince Ryan to go down this path? What was in it for him? Why was, you know, sure, he's a salesman, but does he believe?
We kind of got that
at the
radio station.
A little, but...
Not enough.
Not enough, and not to know, it's like, yeah, I know she's using me, but I'm using her too, and here's how.
Yes. Yes.
They tried to give some answers. They tried to give a little backstory on the Frosts. They tried to give a little backstory here and there. But nothing that had the sophistication and the nuance. And it came down to, we really had two or three camps. We had the Purifiers, we had the Inner Circle, and we had the Underground. And some stuff kind of...
And the Morlocks.
Fair enough. I didn't really see them as having an agenda.
I didn't really consider them as playing a role or being a separate camp until the second to last scene, when Erg was the one who called in sort of the surviving remnants.
What I found interesting with Erg, first off, the Morlocks are from the comics, a long-standing thing during, I want to say, the Claremont era, but I could be wrong on that. Usually, if you want to say something was created in the X-Men run, you could say the Claremont era because it covers so much. It's a safe bet.
Cheater.
Anyways, I'm pretty sure it was him. Anyways. But Erg, the more we saw him, the more he reminded me of Bishop, because Erg's power is to take physical energy and kind of channel it back out as a blast or whatever. He had the M on him, and both of those are iconic aspects of Bishop, although he was from the future. That, why they just didn't call him Bishop, I don't know. But there was also an aspect with how the blast came out of where an eye used to be and stuff like that, a little reminiscent of Cyclops, but also reminiscent of Callisto, who was the leader of the Morlocks in the comics for the longest time. Mm-hmm. So there are a couple of times that they took some canonical comic stuff and twisted it around, which, again, I expect some of that.
Well, I mean, the Morlocks were a mutant-only community.
Mm-hmm.
So, in some respects, they were showing the mutant homeland could work, but their theory was you had to do it in secrecy where the humans couldn't find you.
And I do think isolation, there's a lot to be said for that.
And that was something Reva would never go for.
What would have been interesting would have been if there had been, before we saw the Morlocks, reference to so-and-so's vanished, they say he went into the jungle.
Mm.
And then what you find out later is the Morlocks, well, they've got this sewer system. That's just so they can get to the portal that takes them to this African jungle halfway around the world where they're in the middle of nowhere and they're safe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Almost go with how DC has the Gorilla City
portal
set up.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Mm-hmm. So I think what they were doing here was interesting, but it was so... The Inner Circle was clearly terrorists.
Well, and my problem with Reva was that she would kill mutants just as easily as she would kill humans.
Yeah.
To get what she wanted. And I get that they wanted us to have no doubt that the Inner Circle was terrorists and that Reva was a terrorist. But I don't think that was a line they needed to cross to paint her as a fanatic.
But I think it would have been a more interesting show if we could have had sympathy and understanding and possible buy-in for the Inner Circle's agenda,
mm-hmm.
as well as the Mutant Underground's agenda, as well as the Purifier's agenda, as well as Sentinel Service's agenda.
I think they hoped to give us that in the Inner Circle with Lorna and Andy, in the Purifiers with Turner. I think they thought they were giving us insight into the various groups with Lorna and Andy for the Inner Circle, Turner for the Purifiers, the people we always knew for the Mutant Underground. But that may be why they sent Clarice to the Morlocks.
I think it is, but I would have liked it if, instead of having characters that were the new members and therefore people could explain stuff, if it was something where there was not a clear cut, these are the good guys, these are the bad guys. If you wind up with an untenable situation and there's multiple avenues in it and each one seems reasonable within it, but unreasonable to the others, you could get to where you've set up, if they don't compromise, everybody's doomed, and work towards kind of that win-win situation. It just seemed like here we were so understandably biased towards the Mutant Underground that we never got an episode where the Purifiers, where we could get to see how many of, I mean, imagine if they'd done an episode where it was the Purifiers getting interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you do this? What's this hate group all about? Oh, we're not a hate group. You know, I had this. This is what happened. I'm trying to do right. And we don't hate these people, but it's not safe. We're trying to get them the help they need, or whatever.
If we had had even a flashback scene with that police officer, Ted, where a just manifested mutant had accidentally killed his partner.
Instead, we got a flip side of that with Turner, where his partner was telling him that that had happened. We hadn't seen that. You know, it's like they had the right idea and did it wrong.
That was a flashback with Jace, actually.
That was my point. It wasn't even Jace, though, that had. It was his partner, and we didn't see his partner's situation. We were told about it.
Yeah.
This is why his partner was so hard on this kid, and Jace is like, hey, it's just a kid.
Yeah.
You know, but if we had seen, like you said, the other cop who'd recruited Jace into the Purifiers and understood how he got into the Purifiers and why.
Well, it's not just that, but he was fine with attacking the Morlocks, even when he realized it was women and children, because children grow up to be adults.
But imagine if his situation, that cop situation, had involved a young kid who was just manifesting, and it's like kids can be dangerous too.
Exactly.
You know, and part of where they fudge things a little is both here and in the comics, you've got to basically hit puberty for the mutant power to manifest. Yet in both this show and in the comics, you've got kids younger than that with visible mutant abilities. You know, the fins, the, you know, whatever.
Yeah, both the physical markings, but also, like, at one point in season one, when Polaris was pregnant, being pregnant was affecting her abilities, which was kind of implying that the baby was affecting her abilities.
Yes, but even in the Morlock City, there were young kids that were visibly mutants.
Yeah.
But if they're not old enough to have manifested, how is that? That's one of the things that I think they should have played a little tighter, because if it had basically been anybody can be a mutant, your kid may be fine one day and you wake up the next and they suddenly have, you know, wings or something like that. I could see where that would freak a parent out.
Yeah.
I could see where this isn't natural. You know, they want to do something about it. And if they join the Purifiers just trying to, you know, save kids from whatever is causing this, because they don't believe it's genetic.
Yeah.
Then it's like, okay, I can understand that viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But here, it was really never portrayed as more than just a hate group.
Yeah.
So and I get they only have so much time, simplicity, whatever, but that was the main focus of the entire show, was mutants getting hunted.
Yeah, it was a very hate-focused, violence-focused, fear-focused season.
Well, first season, everything kicked off because the Strucker kids manifested their abilities.
But I guess first season felt like it had hope. They were going to find a place where the family would be safe.
And they were rescuing mutants and stuff like that. Whereas here, the underground had been shattered. They were always on the run. They were,
Yeah. They were separated from Andy.
Yeah. They made some decisions going into the season that sort of split the team. It introduced both the Inner Circle faction and the Purifier faction, played down the Sentinel Services massively. They were really not a factor to be seen at all this season.
Yeah.
They were mentioned, but we never saw Sentinel Services again. That was disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like they course corrected significantly this season, and not in a good direction. It wasn't bad. It was entertaining.
Yeah.
But it made me feel like the people who ran the show last season, the people who ran the show this season, which I think were the same people, said, no, no, let's go this other way.
Yeah.
I'd love to know where they would have taken the show moving forward.
Yeah, that final bit with Blank, the question is, was that meant to be kind of a tie-in to a movie?
Days of Future Past that she was in.
Or an actual redirect for the next season?
I think it was a redirect for the next season, maybe tying into something akin to Days of Future Past. This show liked doing the last minute kind of reveal or tease.
Yeah.
End on this moment or whatever. And particularly with that, they had teased a little an episode before that maybe Blink wasn't dead.
Yeah.
But gave us really nothing solid to go on. So for her to pop out of nowhere, oh, she's fine. Hey, let's go here. And her abilities are different.
Mm-hmm.
Not massively, but more like in the comic version where she had these darts she could throw. I think it was supposed to get us, oh, wow, I can't wait to see what happens next. And I can, and I have to, because I'll never see what happens next. Yeah. They're not doing it.
Well, and I was more intrigued by the scene with Erg, where he was saying, you know, people have heard what happened here. The people who were kind of rallied by the mutant uprising, they're looking for leadership.
Yeah, you guys can now lead that, and it gave a more hopeful sign.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was setting Erg up as a recurring, if not a regular, Esme up as a member of their team again.
Yes. Well,
it was almost getting back to more how it was first season.
Well, and Esme had an interesting arc this season.
Mm-hmm.
And bless your heart, you actually paused at my request on a specific frame for the triplets.
With the three Frosts, one of them would always have their arms crossed in front of their chest. One would have a hand on the hip, and the other would have the hands just kind of in front of them, right over left or something like that.
One hand holding the other wrist.
Yeah. And you had commented on that, and I'm like, yeah, I think it does relate to the which one they are. And between that night and when we watched tonight, I'd done a little searching on the web, and I found a Reddit thread interviewing Skylar, who plays them, saying, yeah, some of it's split screen, some of it's green screen, some of it's face replacement. They even have on-hand FX to kind of show how it's all fitting together. She has body doubles and stuff, but that the crossed arms is Esme, the hand on the wrist thing is Sophie, and the hand on the hip is Phoebe. Just ways that they use to kind of tell the characters apart.
Yeah.
And that they're implying there were other ones like that. And it was interesting, but then in the last episode, the way the arms were and what the characters were saying and who they were calling each other didn't match.
Yeah, there was a point at which a non-Esme had the folded arms.
Yes.
Yeah,
and
I noticed that.
From what I was reading, I don't blame the actress.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, because they tried hard to keep it straight. But I had noticed early in the season, because I was looking at it at one point and I'm like, I don't think it's like sign language for ESP, but it's very clear to me it's being done deliberately.
Well, and they were always positioned ESP in terms of Esme, Sophie, and Phoebe. What's interesting, Sophie and Phoebe are the ones who died in the comics.
Well, and I wasn't positive what happened to them at the end here. Were they knocked out? Were they actually killed?
They did not reveal.
That's what I thought.
It seemed like they were alive when we left the three of them, but the other two were never seen again.
Yeah.
In the comics, Sophie was the first to die, having taken Kick, which is the drug they had referenced at one point early in the season. And then, I guess Phoebe was the next to die. That left Esme, Mindy, or Irma, and then, whichever the fifth one is, I can never keep them all track. The first names spelled out in the comics originally Spice. Sugar and Spice, what girls are made of type thing, or the Spice Girls. The problem was, Grant Morrison, who created them, only gave the names for four of the five. So Irma wound up being named Mindy by another writer, and then another writer said, oh, that's not what he had wanted, so she goes by this, but her name is that kind of a thing.
Yeah, but if your name was Irma, wouldn't you pick
Celeste
something?
Celeste was the other one, the C. To me, that's it. If you're going to do that kind of naming to spell something out, you're obligated to name all of the characters in the comic.
Yeah.
Just not a bad idea.
Well, Esme had the most time out of captivity, if you will, out in the real world. So it makes sense that she was the most reachable
Yes.
of the triplets.
I'm trying to remember if first season we'd seen... I'm trying to remember when the other two came in and if they had rescued them.
They rescued them very That's late right. in the season.
That's right.
Now, to me, it's fascinating that Polaris is the one who reached the humanity in Esme.
Yes. Well, in the comics, Polaris is bipolar and sometimes just a little off. It's crazy.
To me, she's very Jessica Jones.
Yeah. I think if I had been behind this, I would have treated the Frosts a little differently. First, as great as this actress did, and she did a terrific job, I would have actually cast identical triplets.
Mm.
Just for the simplicity of it, and because usually as identical as they are, you in some cases you can get to identify which is which.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would have helped differentiate.
Yeah.
And I also would have done what they tend to do with Triplicate Girl in the Legion of Superheroes, where it's the same outfit, but color-coded.
Mm, yeah.
You know, with Triplicate Girl, it would be an orange, a purple, and I forget what the other color would be or something like that. Here, they're wearing the exact same thing. And from a filming point of view, sure. Certainly simplifies the hell out of things.
That's what I was going to say. From a production standpoint, I get why they did it.
But if you had, triplets,
yeah,
you don't have the issue once they're in their costume or their outfit.
Yeah, at one point I was telling you I wished they were wearing ESP necklaces. Just something to let us know.
Yeah. So when they got the episode with the backstory on them, I appreciated that and thought mm-hmm. that was good and had payoff later.
Yeah. Yeah, so, surprisingly good payoff given how many of the backstory segments didn't have all that much payoff.
Yeah, they like to do that flashback at the beginning of every episode, and sometimes it tied in, other times it's like, yeah, I could have guessed that.
Yeah.
Doesn't really help. So I think they had an interesting idea. I think they were trying to do, for the X-Men, kind of sort of what Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was doing for the cinematic universe, TV tie-in.
Okay.
But it was a little further removed.
Yeah.
And it was an X-Men-free X-Men show.
Yeah.
Even though it literally did have X-Men, Sage, Polaris, the Frosts, Thunderbird, you know. But the X-Men canon is so huge, there's so many others they could have brought in. That this could have been more than just, hey, we're fugitives always on the run.
Well, at one point when we were rescuing the Morlocks as they were evacuating, we got to a point where Lauren couldn't tap into her powers. She's there with her mother and then a bunch of Morlocks in the car. And Lauren's like, I can't do it. I can't use my powers. Oh, then I'll have to ram the police cars. And I'm calling out to you. Why are they not asking what can everybody else in the car do?
I think they'd already established a lot of those Morlocks did not have those kinds of powers. Well, but still, they could have asked. If they had had, I don't have much, I can do this. And they had found a way to take some pretty minor powers and actually do something clever with them.
Yeah, I was going to say, there are a lot of powers that might not be good for defense, offense,
out and out.
Yeah, but they might actually be good for getting you past the cops in some way.
Yeah.
Even if it's, all I can do is, bend that light post and make a ramp.
All I can do is change the color of something.
Yes.
Gosh, they're looking for a blue car. Let's make this one red.
Yeah.
Something like that. You know, the other approach to this kind of a show that could have been really interesting, do it as almost an anthology show.
Mm.
Where you're following Jamie Madrox every week as he's going and checking in on this mutant in hiding here, this mutant in hiding there, or helping this mutant out or whatever.
Yeah.
And the reason I say Jamie Madrox, he was actually one we've seen in the X-Men movies. He's the Multiple Man.
Ah, nice. Yeah.
So we're following the same character, but if you get it to where at one point you realize we may be following them literally at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, and there's two or three of them or something like that. Because you could actually have, he's over here with them dealing with somebody. Oh, he can't be in two places. Oh, he can be in two places at once. But you could do a riff on that kind of iconic traveling loner sort of a show
mm-hmm.
to help people or whatever with, a different angle on it.
Yeah.
You know, particularly if he's always calling back to the home office. And mm-hmm. at the end of the first episode, you realize, wait, he's there too.
Yeah.
So I think there are ways they could have explored the X-Men franchise, the mutant franchise, a little deeper, a little better than they did here. This was not bad, but again, I'm not surprised it ended after two seasons.
Yeah, I agree.
So, anything else on this?
I think that does it.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.